Accession number 27347, reel 23.
Stanley Brand, reel 23.
With the weather and operating away from the ship, did you ever have problems with weather changes from the time you're taking off to the time of coming back? And how did that affect your flying?
Yes, because we were out of radio and radar touch with the convoy, it was left to us to decide whether we pressed on or turned back when we met weather that was closing in. If we knew it was closing in rapidly, we would try and get back to the ship on the principle that you know where you are and you know that there are no subs on the surface in that area, or the area that you've covered. Is it safe for you to go back or not? And you'd decide whether to go back. The observer would decide, or the pilot would decide if he had seniority. But my observer had a fortnight seniority over me, so he could make all the decisions.
But you've obviously said a little bit about the relationships between pilots and observers.
Yes.
Anyway, I take it from that condition you would never question.
But you wouldn't have time to discuss it. To discuss your action would be an almost certain way of making sure that you ballsed it up, because you'd get conflicting opinions and nobody to decide which opinion was predominant. No, the old naval attitude of seniority gives authority held good. I do think that the relationship between myself and Bill, my observer, was such that if he'd given me an instruction that I felt was had a flaw in it, I would say, but, and he would have listened to me. But in the meantime, I would have been conforming to his suggestion. I'd be acting along the lines that he wanted, and butting, while there's still time to change my course. I had sufficient confidence in him that he'd have good arguments against my butt. But not everybody had. There were cases, particularly in MAC ships, where the seniority of the observer over the pilot would be small, but there was no cohesion between them. They were bound to split up after a while, especially sharing a cabin, because they one tended to discuss things in private in a cabin when you were sharing it with somebody, and you could go over the decisions that had been made, and it either gave you confidence in your oppo or gave you confidence that you ought to be applying for a change of aircrew.
One other thing that is very much the realm of the pilot is landing on and taking off in those conditions, because of course although you'd practice deck landings in the Clyde, what about taking off and landing on a MAC ship that's in the middle of the ocean with
those things? Well, it was purely that it was dependent upon the skills you'd acquired during your training. Just as a car driver can only be judged by what he does in the fractions of a second that he has to make decisions when a crash is imminent. When he sees something on the motorway that the lorry in front has turned sideways, it's the action of the person in emergency which either gives you confidence or destroys the confidence. My observer and air gunner never once criticized my performance. I never knew whether this was sheer loyalty, not wanting to offend me, or because of perfection on my part.
I was thinking, do you have to judge, though, if the carrier is going up and down, you mentioned 15 or
20
feet.
Yes.
How do you judge your landings as you're coming in with that? Did you...
The batsman.
You
it's the batsman. The batsman tells through his feet what is happening. And his eyes are on the aircraft. And because he is going up and down with the stern, but to him, the relative motion, he is stationary and the plane is going up and down, he can judge then whether the plane needs to be higher or lower relative to where he is. In other words, the deck. And if he sees that the pilot is going to be above the deck by too much of a distance to stop his engine because he'd just stall in, he's got to wave him off before it gets to that position. This is one of the reasons why old Surtees was right in saying that complete obedience is necessary. You have to obey the batsman's instructions because he is the only one in a position to judge. I couldn't judge whether the stern was going to come up or go down or do a corkscrew. But the batsman could tell through his feet.
We kind of went away a little bit from the narrative and talked in generalities about the MAC ships there. If you can pick it up again, obviously you're at Maydown.
Yes.
What was the first ship that you were drafted to, and when did that occur?
Well, there's an episode before that. Obviously, the people in the office had some idea of when a convoy would be coming in, but it was all masked in secrecy. The point came where they said to us, you can go away for a 72-hour leave, but you must remain in touch, and on recall you must return immediately. So, all right, we were given 72 hours leave. What do you do in Northern Ireland? You can't get home. We went to the padre and said, what can we do in the time? Can you recommend somewhere to go? And he said, oh, well, there's the Nuffield Fund, Lord Nuffield's Fund, where I can get free accommodation for you with free food in a hotel. But I can't give you the travelling time, the travelling money, or any drinks money. But I've got vacancies at quite a few hotels in Northern Ireland. Where would you like to go? Somewhere on the coast, somewhere inland, country, farm? And we said, oh, seaside, because the Antrim coast is beautiful. And he said, there's a quiet hotel at Portrush. So he said, I'll check whether they've got vacancies. So he went away, got on the blower. He said, yes, we've got room for three at the Seabank Hotel at Portrush, full of old ladies, retirement hotel sort of thing, but they'll look after you. So off we went to the Seabank Hotel at Portrush. And I got there, we went into reception. We were booked in by a very pleasant young lady, and we went to bed, and we were tired. We'd been doing quite a lot of exercises, and next morning was a Sunday, and we came down at about 9:30, had our breakfast, and then Bill suggested let's all go to church. So we went down to reception and said, can you direct us to the Presbyterian church, because Bill was a Presbyterian. And the young lady said, oh, I'm just going there myself to the Presbyterian church, if you like to come along. So her and one of her colleagues and the three of us went off. We went to the Presbyterian church, and we sat through a very boring service, and then came out and thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a cup of coffee? So we asked if there was any place in Portrush, wartime, Sunday morning. No, come back to the hotel, we'll organise it. So we went back to the hotel, and they organised... They said they'd organised coffee in the room above the entrance. And Bill said, oh, I'd like to get a newspaper. I'm just going back into town to get a newspaper. And Johnny said, oh, I'll go with him. And Rita's friend said, oh, I've got to make out some bills because people are moving. And eventually it left Rita and myself. I think it was all predetermined by all of them. Rita and myself having coffee, a big pot, enough for half a dozen people, just the two of us. So we sat there till about 5 o'clock in the evening. We got to know each other, and she's the girl I eventually married. Yes, the old dears couldn't do enough for us. And there was another incident. We went for a walk on the Monday morning. We went along to the White Rocks, along a beautiful sandy shore that stretched about 7 miles. And we'd got about halfway along, and we saw a crowd of people in front of us at about the high water mark. And as we got close, some of them came running towards us. Because we're in uniform, they thought we were coast guards. Oh, there was an unexploded bomb there. So we said, well, stand clear. That's the first thing to do, but we'll have a look at it. So we had a look at it and decided that since it was at the high water mark, it must have floated. If it floated, it couldn't be a bomb. It would be a smoke marker. So we examined it and found it was a smoke float. But because it caused consternation, we thought we'd better get rid of it somehow, and the only way we could think of was to take it to the Coast Guard. And Johnny, my air gunner, said, why should we carry it? Look at all these young lads here, they love to carry it. So we got a gang of young boys, about 10, 11, 12, who carried the smoke float. Before that, we'd had a dog came up to us with a stick in its mouth, obviously wanting a game. And it crouched with its backside in the air, and like a starter, like a runner at the starting line. and we kept throwing the stick for it. And then just before we picked up this smoke float, didn't the dog go and cock his hind leg against it, and it brought cheers from the crowd. But anyway, to get to the coast guards, we had to go past the sea bank, and obviously somebody told the old dears that these brave young men from the Fleet Air Arm had found an unexploded bomb and they were taking it to the coast guard. So they came out and there were photographs being taken, and well, they treated us like heroes. The more we protested and said, look, it's just an empty tin can, the more they said what heroes we were. We couldn't do enough at that hotel. They fed us like conquering heroes, and the old dears made sure that we had reading matter. One old dear wanted to give us some pound notes as well, which we turned down. But anyway, it made sure that next time we went to the Sea Bank Hotel, which was going to be quite frequent because of my relationship with Rita, they always gave us a room without any trouble at all. We were always booked in. We eventually got a message by phone to say we were to return at once, and that was just after we got back, having deposited the smoke float. So it was an excuse to get away. We were glad of it. So we went back to Maidown, and we were told that we were to meet the oil tanker Mack ship Alexia in the Firth of Clyde next day at, I think it was 10 a.m, something like that. So we were all ready. Our aircraft had to be painted with the identification letters M for Mack ship, 3 because we were the third aircraft, and Q for Q flight. M3Q had to be painted on the side, which was done, and next morning off we went to meet Alexia.
What kind of camouflage did you...
It was mainly a dull grey-white on the underside, and on the top side, broken shades of green with a few odd touches of white, just like breakers on a sea, so that if anybody was looking down on us, mind, who was going to look down on us in the Atlantic apart from my colleagues aboard ship when we did a beat up? They could look down on me. So off we went next morning to Alexia, and I'll never forget Johnny's signal to them. He did it by oldest lamp. It was, "Hello, Mum, have you got a place for me?" And Alexia replied, "Come in, but mind the step." So in we went, and that was our first landing on a Mack ship, and I thought, God, how small it is. Am I going to be doing this for a living or a dying? I'm not quite sure. But it was as steady as a rock being in the Clyde, sheltered. I touched down, and immediately the batsman climbed up the side. He said, "Don't get out, don't get out, you're going to do some exercises." So they had the other two aircraft ranged up in the bow. They moved me right to the stern and brought the two from the bow back to the stern, flight commander number 2 and me number 3. So they loaded us up with depth charges, explosive deck, the real thing. And that's because the visibility wasn't good enough to do rockets. So off we went. We did a... we split up and did a navigation exercise and then a rendezvous back in the Firth of Clyde, and then we did some depth charge dropping against a towed target. There was a launch towing a target, which was my first experience of a combined attack, where we went in 1, 2, 3 like that, from different angles, one from astern to ahead, another one on the port beam and the other one on the starboard beam, and so that it didn't matter which way he changed direction, we'd have to go over him. So we dropped the depth charges. Sorry, we dropped one at a time. That's right. We dropped one depth charge each and then repeated the whole thing again. Formed up, went round, and again got the signal to attack. And then we went. And then we went back and landed on. And because it was in the Firth of Clyde, there was no movement on the ship. So that as soon as the plane landed, they unhooked the hook from the wire, and he opened up on the engine and taxied it forward. So it was very click, very swift. And the three of us got down in something like 20 seconds. We were just one behind the other. Yes, it was a very slick piece of operation. And the ground... the ship's crew were cock-a-hoop about it. But the main thing was to get a boat launched, the ship's launched, to go and pick up the dead fish from the around the depth charges. And we had fresh fish for 3 days in the Clyde before we had to join the convoy. The convoy was coming up from Liverpool, joined with other ships from Barrow in Furness, from Larne and the Clyde. So we all formed up outward bound, with stragglers all over the place, rounding them up. That was our first experience of being sheepdogs. It was an experience.
With the convoy, in that first convoy, what's the shape of a convoy? What position does everything take?
It was a 60-ship convoy. And I'm trying to remember exactly how many. I can't remember exactly how many were in each column, but it formed up like a letter E without the middle tongue, with all the strokes very, very thick. Of course, it was. It's the only way I can describe, or like a rectangle with a bite out of the one side, the long side, and the Mack ship operated in this bite that was taken out of the middle, where the tongue of the letter E would have been. The idea of this was that it was protected by lines of ships on all sides, so that if a torpedo was fired at it, that torpedo would have to run the gauntlet of merchant ships and oil tankers, of course. But it gave us the opportunity to turn into wind, whichever way the wind was coming from, without us getting astern of the convoy and in the most vulnerable position.
What speed would the convoys be travelling at? And is there any regulations on that?
The speed of the slowest. The convoys were categorised. There were the ON convoys, which were up to 10 knots, between 8 and 10 knots. And then there were the ONS, which were 4 to 6 knots. And the actual speed, of course, was dictated by the convoy in practice, where they had to look after the slowest. And the slowest could vary from day to day, depending on mechanical condition. One convoy we had, which was had a Greek tramp steamer, which I think had been laid up from about 1922 right through to 1939. It was a rust bucket. Engines always breaking down. We eventually had to dismiss her and tell her to go back to Londonderry under her own steam because she wasn't fit for a convoy. But we hit a gale just as we got out into the open Atlantic, and in 12 days we went backwards about 20 miles because everybody was just hove to, keeping steerage way, keeping the bow into the storm. It was a virtual hurricane. The winds of 65 and 70 miles an hour. And there were terrible conditions. The convoy scattered all over the place. And that was our first experience of rounding up stragglers.
And obviously in those conditions that were slightly rough, and you being at sea for the first time any day, were you seasick at all?
I felt sick. But as soon as... as soon as I had to fly, I forgot about it. I had something to do.
So once the gale had blown itself out, your main job then was picking up these stragglers, bringing them back together.
Yes. And in that time, the convoy just limped along slowly to give the others a chance to catch up.
As it was an outbound convoy from the UK to
Canada.
Canada.
And on to New York, actually. Some of it went on to New York.
Was it carrying cargoes, or was it mainly ballast?
Mainly ballast. There were some things which were, I suppose, payment. There were valuables. There were certain ores, metallic ores. There were certain... aircraft components. At that time, they were they'd equipped the Mustang with an Allison engine, and it wasn't very successful. So we were shipping Rolls-Royce engines out to them as a sort of reverse lease lend. And from then on, the Mustang became a very, very effective aircraft.